This is The Lucky Country, a weekly podcast brought to you by Schwartz Media, the publisher of the monthly and the Saturday paper, and Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. The Saturday paper's the source of quality long-form journalism every weekend, and the monthly is the country's best magazine of politics, culture, and ideas.
Hi, I'm Richard Dennis, Chief Economist at the Australia Institute. Welcome to The Lucky Country. In this episode, I talk to former Greens leader Bob Brown about democracy and why it is that so many people who say they support democracy are actually quite threatened by the idea of one person, one vote. You'll hear what I mean a little later in the podcast. I also talk to Chris Fry in our Sensible Centre segment. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Chris is a little less optimistic than Bob. But first, we need to talk about economics. Many people on the progressive side of politics are, understandably, deeply sceptical of neoliberalism, economic rationalism, and the full suite of right-wing economic arguments that have been used to justify decades of cutting taxes for corporations, cutting spending on essential services, and doing enormous harm to the natural environment in order to increase GDP. But, shameless plug alert, in my quarterly essay, Dead Right, I argue that the opposite of neoliberal economics isn't progressive economics, but simply an engaged democracy. The Federal Minister for Resources, Matt Canavan, wants to subsidise new coal mines because he wants Australia to have more coal mines. I, on the other hand, would like to subsidise dental care because I want Australia to have more dental care. Minister Canavan and I both agree that subsidies work. We simply disagree about what Australia needs more of. That's not an economic question, that's simply a democratic question. Similarly, Tony Abbott wants to nationalise coal-fired electricity generators. On the other hand, I'd like to have a nationally owned bank. So Tony Abbott and I agree that nationalisation of important economic entities is a good idea. We just disagree which ones need to be nationalised. That's not an economic debate. It's a democratic debate. So here we are in 2018, one of the richest countries in the world, living at the richest point in world history, wondering whether we need more coal mines, more dental care, more joint strike fighters, or a more generous welfare sector. Neoliberalism's best trick was to convince us that these are economic questions, when of course they're simply democratic questions. We're lucky to live in a country that can afford to do anything it wants. The only problem is the democratic one of deciding what we want. I'll leave that up to you. My first guest is Bob Brown, former leader of the Australian Greens. Bob Brown, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country.
Pleasure, Richard.
Bob, for many years you've opposed subsidies for logging, you've supported a price on carbon, and indeed you've supported an individual's right to choose who they want to marry. Have you always been a neoliberal?
I think I have been conservative in believing that the market should look after itself, but also that the state, that is, in a democratic country, the elected representatives have a right to overlook that market in the interests of the greater number. That's a bit of Benthamism, that the interests of the wider populace should prevail if the market's just serving the interests of a small number. And of course, same with individual rights. It was always clear to me that people should be able to love whoever they like, and that that wasn't a place for intervention. But it's come around in my lifetime that the majority of people have felt that way. I guess as there's been a decline in belief of some almighty other being, and a recognition that we human beings on this little planet are here to organise our own society and indeed our own future.
So Bob, how do you think it's come to pass that in Australia it's so common for people on the right of Australian politics to assert their support for free markets and simultaneously want to subsidise
logging or coal mining, or say they support individuals' rights to choose over regulation and red tape, but then they oppose women's right to have an abortion or a couple's right to get married if they're of the same gender. How have they got away with this for so long?
Well, I think that I think your essay on this has really nailed it. It's about greed and self-interest. And to be able to get away with that, you can't say, I am greedy, therefore I'm going to do this, unless you're in a Hollywood movie where you can say greed is good. But in real life, you have to be able to mask the fact that you're out for yourself and you're going to get an advantage on anybody else that you can. And that's, of course, how the market and the monetary system tends to go, or at least operators who are really in the business of self-serving and self-interest will want to cover up the fact that they're doing that so that all other good people, good-hearted people, will allow them to the full length of the leash to get away with it. It's a masking operation.
Yeah, I think you're right, but I guess that mask is starting to slip, and I find it really interesting. Now, you know, most people listening to this will probably know that you're not a millennial or a Gen X, but they might not know that you were, well, certainly one of the first podcasters I ever heard. You've been an early adopter of a whole range of new communication technologies and indeed the social media over the years. Do you think that with the rise of social media, with the diversity of opinion that can now be found not just on social media but simply through online newspapers as well as the traditional media, do you think that's helped breaking down the old sort of left versus right two ways of looking at things?
Well, yes and no, because I was just reading in The Guardian the other day that that we're seeing the creation or the taking to themselves, because that's what it's about, of one new billionaire on the planet per day. And the richest one, who owns Amazon, gained, I forget, $14, $16 billion in one day with a change in share prices just last year. Now, that's totally obscene. But that's been facilitated by the private ownership, if you like, of the new media, with very, very little government intervention on behalf of the wider populace. So I think that old forms, old habits that go right back through history, whereas fast movers will get the advantage over the rest of the populace unless there's somebody that intervenes on it.
Yeah.
And that ought to be a representative parliament, is still at play.
Well, that's a great example because, yeah, of course, we hear the old media all the time talking about the need to regulate Google, the need to regulate Facebook, the need to regulate Twitter. And indeed,
and by the way, the communist Chinese do it very well.
Well, they do, don't they? And those same old media outlets are also quick to say that Google doesn't pay enough tax and that the social media companies don't pay enough tax. So, yeah, I think you put your finger on it. I think that there's probably no clearer example of this sort of hypocrisy about is regulation good or bad, or is tax good or bad, than the old media's response to the new media companies. And
that's true, Richard, and I hope the Murdoch media doesn't listen to this conversation, because the antidote to a lot of this globalisation of the means of communication as well as the means of buying and selling and so much else that we're seeing through cyberspace ought to be regulated. And who's going to regulate that except a global government? And who should be a global government except a global democracy that has one person, one value, one vote? That's thinking that seems to be right out of decency. If you've only got to bring that up and you see eyes roll and people, particularly in the conventional media, go crook about it. But how else are we going to organise ourselves as a single community on this planet in the future with resource limits applied by the planet itself as our population goes from currently nearly 8 billion to closer to 12 billion just this century. We really need some fresh thinking about who's got the right to organise the planet for the future. Will it be the people, or is it simply going to be big corporate and technologically powerful interests? It's a question everybody's got to answer.
So are you suggesting that support for democracy shouldn't end at the national border, and that people who think that democracy is an important objective need to think about it globally as well as nationally? That's crazy talk, isn't it?
Oh, well, according to the Australian, yes. But no, it's not. It's, as Winston Churchill said in 1947, democracy's got a whole pile of faults, but it's better than whatever else was tried. And at the moment, unfortunately, we are having our interest taken over by individuals or companies who are self-interested but telling us they're good for us. And that includes the mass communication companies and the startups that are coming in the future that we simply can't chart at the moment. These need to be regulated in the interests of a planetary order in the future. We are undeniably now a planetary community. We've got a single destiny. We'll get on together, or we'll fall together. And that can't be left in the hands of self-appointed mega billionaires. I'd much sooner see it in the hands of everybody equally who aspires to the future. I think it's be a much safer world if we do it through democracy.
Well, of course, I guess that was the logic behind the setting up of the United Nations, and of course its precursors. After world wars, after terrible events, the idea that perhaps we want to work together has seemed more important. I guess with issues like climate change, it seems many are waiting until there's terrible events to figure out a way to work together on such things. What do you think is going to remind us that perhaps we need to work together at an international level on these things?
Well, another good question, Richard, and the question is, are we pre-catastrophic species? In other words, can we use our intelligence to ward off catastrophe? Or are we post-catastrophic? Are we going to wait until there is a catastrophe overtakes humanity? And some scientists are predicting the population won't be 12 billion by the end of the century, it'll be 1 billion. And I think we're already using 160% of the Earth's living renewable resources. That's why there's less forest, less fisheries, less arable land, more mouths to feed, less species and so on every morning at the moment. Now, that's not doom and gloom. That's just the reality of the situation we're in. And either we get together to sensibly say, well, let's put some order into this chaos and let's put some limits into this limited world. But at the moment, in a world driven by on-the-make people, and of course neoliberalism is the height of the absurdity of that, people feel powerless, and very often, if they're intelligent, feel depressed about the fact that we can't get our act together. I'm one of those who believe we can get our act together. And naming the biggest problem, and that is the arrogation of power by the wealthy to themselves, this plutocracy that we're seeing emerge around the planet, has got to be a starting point, because that's got to be kept in order. And that will only be kept in order if people get active and people do take part in the democratic process to get a better outcome for the wider good.
Well, I'll come back to the global in a minute, but that point about having an active role in democracy, I mean, Australians are reporting lower and lower degrees, lower and lower levels of faith in our democratic institution. And increasingly, the number of people who are even sceptical about democracy is on the rise. I guess I just want to talk about the access to our democratic processes in Australia. I mean, There's plenty of metaphors in your time in public life. I mean, once upon a time we could walk over the top of Parliament House, and first they gave us the bollards and then they gave us the enormous fins. Do you think it's getting harder and harder for ordinary people to access parliamentarians and to access the shaping of decisions? And if so, what can we do about it?
Well, it appears to be, but really it's getting easier. It's much easier for an average member of the populace to pick up the phone or go down to the office of their local parliamentarian and insist on a hearing now than it ever was before. Maybe that's an outcome of the fact that we're richer than ever before and we've got more mobility, and most of us are literate and are able to express ourselves. But people don't want to get out of their comfort zone. People are comfortable, we are wealthy, and in amongst the world of grizzle, which is no less in Australia than anywhere else around the planet, people don't want to be discomforted, and I'm afraid that's a recipe for some bad outcomes. We are all empowered. We are all in, at least in a democracy like Australia, we all have the ability to A, get to our politicians, and B, replace them if we don't like it. But, you know, at the last federal election, 90% of people voted for the Adani coal mine in Queensland, the mega for the billionaire from India to open up this potentially catastrophic coal mine with its impact on global climate change, and six coal ports inside the Great Barrier Reef. When I say to people, well, everybody who voted for Labor or Clive Palmer or Pauline Hanson or the Coalition or Barnaby Joyce voted for that, they say, oh, no, I didn't. I voted for a tax break, or I voted for better funding for something or other. Well, there's the question. Are we going to vote for ourselves now, the immediate self-interest, or are we going to vote for those coming after us? In other words, put the long-term interest of this country and this planet at the forefront. And it's T.K. Galbraith, the great American economist at the end of last century, just said Congress almost exactly reflects the people who vote for it. There are voting alternatives, and every one of us has the potential to stand for Parliament if we don't like the alternatives. But I see very little, I hear much more moaning about it than I see action to rectify the representation that we have at all levels of governance in Australia.
Well, that's great. That's led me back to the question I wanted to come back to, which is the global one. But perhaps not everyone listening realises that you helped set up what was one of, if not the first, green parliamentary parties in Australia, the United Tasmania Party. What prompted a medical doctor to not just go into politics, but to try and change politics? What on earth were you thinking?
Well, I did write a letter to the paper saying that in the two-party system, voting for the lesser of two evils is still voting for an evil. And I was contacted by Richard Jones, who is actually the founder of the United Tasmania Group, that first Greens party in the world back in 1973. And to cut a long story short, I found this new party, which stood for a long-term view, the environment, for organic agriculture, for the rights of women and Aboriginal people, were right back then promoting the arts and already looking at the limits to the planet. It seemed to be a good alternative. So I did get involved, and along with Drew Hutton and others, then moved on to establish the Australian Greens. But, you know, we have a great range of potential alternatives in our public, in our political system, and you hear it's always condemned if anybody dares to interrupt the two-party system. But it's high time we had a multi-party system, and indeed in Australia, a proportional representation so that everybody's vote is roughly equal, like they've got in New Zealand and most countries in Europe. But at the moment, we don't have that except in the Senate. But we do have a growing range of political parties, including the Greens, and the bigger the reins, the better. At least it gives people a better suite of alternatives to select from, rather than the lookalike older parties who are suborned. They really are unable to move outside a fairly tight straitjacket of what the corporate world wants, and that's not really what the average citizen wants if you get down to Tim Tacks and talk to them about where the world should be going.
Well, Bob, my feelings are hurt. As a proud Canberran, you've forgotten that here in the ACT, we not only have proportional representation, but we've managed to elect a multi-party government in which the Greens are in balance of power with Labor and have been for many years, delivering us 100% renewable energy target and public transport investment and all sorts of things. So don't forget about us here in the capital.
Oh, well, that's a great example. It's a fantastic example of where proportional representation works better for the people.
Why do you think we haven't had more of a debate about that? And of course, proportional representation means that we don't just elect one person for each electorate, that you elect a number of people. So in our Senate, of course, it's 12 senators for each state. Why do you think that the idea of proportional representation has been so invisible, really, in debates about how to invigorate Australia's democracy?
Well, when I was in the Senate, I brought it up a number of occasions. It never got covered in the media, as far as I can recollect. But the big parties hate it, and in particular the Labor Party. The number of people voting away from the big parties is growing. It's currently somewhere between 20 and 30%. Put proportional representation into that, and that means 20 to 30% of the House of Reps would be non-Liberal National Labor Party persons. You can see why the big parties are horrified by the thought. They don't want democracy. They want power. They want those treasury benches for themselves. And again, it's only going to be people power that would ever change that. The one good thing I can recall in history about this is Catherine Helen Spence, the unacknowledged mother of Federation. She was very active in South Australia, in Adelaide, promoting proportional representation when the Federation of Australia was forming. And Andrew Inglis Clark, the Attorney General in Tasmania, hence the Hare Clark system of voting proportional representation, which Tasmania got a century ago, got together and at least influenced the writers of the Constitution so that you don't need a referendum to change the voting system. At any time, the Parliament of Australia could change to proportional representation for the House of Representatives. But and as I say, that has been the idea has been put forward, but the big parties don't want it. And until we get the public saying, well, we want our vote to count. If we vote away from the big parties, we want it to be of equal value. Until we get a voter revolution of that sort, we won't see that change. But I think somewhere down the line, it happened in New Zealand, just the circumstances were right 20 years ago, and somewhere down the line it's going to come to Australia, and it will be a good thing for democracy when it does.
Well, here on The Lucky Country, we like to talk about big ideas, and Bob, reinvigorating our domestic politics with proportional representation and setting up a global democracy sounds like a few nice points to put on the to-do list. So thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country.
Thanks, Richard.
That was Bob Brown, former leader of the Australian Greens. And now I'm joined by my regular guest, Chris Fry.
Chris Fry, thanks for joining us back in the Sensible Centre.
I'm always here, Richard. Nice for you to come back.
Look, I want to talk about proportional representation. Now, in Australian Parliament, we have a lower house and an upper house, and our lower house MPs are elected to represent a particular area. So if you live in the seat of Sydney, everyone in that seat votes, and the politician that gets gets a majority of the votes in that electorate after preferences is the one and only member for that electorate. So we're used to that. We have 150 people in the lower house. But of course, there are other proposals, including proportional representation, where rather than have one person elected for each region, you pick a bigger region and you let everyone in that electorate, in that bigger electorate, elect multiple people. So that if a party got 100% of the votes, they'd get 100% of the seats. But if they only got half of, or 51% of the votes, they might only get 50% of the seats. And if a minor party got 20% of the vote, then they'd get 20% of the seats. What do you think of that idea, Chris?
I'm not in favour of it. I live in the halfway house that you're referring to, Richard, as do you, which is the ACT. We and Tasmania have a quasi-PR system, which is
proportional representation.
Yeah, which is the state between single member electorates and full PR, and that is multi member electorates. In the ACT, at the local level, we have 25 members, five from each one. This is the Hare Clark system based on what happened in Tasmania. The reason why I don't like it is because I see it in action. I concede the point that it is very representative in terms of aggregate votes. The trouble is, the outcome is hamstrung government. And it's hard enough to do anything in government, in my view, certainly anything good. The adding another layer of complexity and argument is very bad, I think, and it makes people, it's part of the reason why I think people are turning off more and more in politics, because it gives another layer for the media to create or indeed rejoice in three things: uncertainty, because people don't have a majority normally; secondly, division; and thirdly, it deals in to very large positions of influence. People who, frankly, I wouldn't feed mostly, don't have a clue what they're doing. that brings further disdain into thing, and it kills any kind of sensible reform as well.
We'll come back to the specific systems in a minute. But to be clear, your preference is that we effectively have majority governments who can implement the agenda they took to the election. If they do that well, they'll get re-elected. If they stray too far from it, they'll be thrown out. And then another majority government gets a chance. You're quite comfortable in Queensland, for example, where they have no upper house. You like the idea of a majority elected government pretty much being able to do what they want, subject to the constitution, for their term of office.
That's exactly what I want, and I don't agree with your original characterization of it. In terms of if a government does what it says, it gets re-elected. I think that is this current kind of truth myth that perpetuates politics, which again poisons it, because it doesn't allow for the real world where things change all the time. But no, I just think that governments make decisions, they are allowed to implement them, and then the public actually gets to decide what they think of them. At the moment, we have a weird hybrid, and which blurs accountability. It's actually good in a way for incumbents, but I just don't think it's good for the country.
But you say weird hybrid. I mean, our constitution spells it out pretty clearly. We have a lower house, we have an upper house. They're elected in different ways to represent different communities. The tension between the two is a design feature. It's a check and a balance. It's not there by accident. What's the problem with checks and balances?
There are none necessarily. But let's be clear. I don't think that all wisdom, say in the Australian Constitution, it resounded with 50 guys in the 1890s. It's just rubbish. But more to the point, in terms of the states, the reason why we have the current system is because it was an evolutionary model. Legislative councils were formed first, which was terrific, which had very, very limited franchise, if any franchise. And then over time, they were augmented by a popularly elected lower house. And in Queensland's case, they managed to convince enough of the upper house members to vote for abolition. Robert Ray once told me it was because they were all promised a lifetime gold pass on the Queensland Railways. I don't know if that's true, but it probably is.
High expectations.
Like, wow, you know, exactly. Narrow gauge, you know, in those days. So what that means, I think, is that people can actually engage in ideas, think about them, vote that way, and then judge people on the basis of whether they deliver or not. Not in terms of being truthful or not, but whether or not the ideas were good ideas. Now, not everyone votes like that, of course not. And it's ludicrous to assert that. But nonetheless, it does provide accountability. And if you go too far, which is my view, which is what silly right-wing governments do a lot, and silly left-wing governments would do if they ever got into power, they would be voted out.
So here we are in the ACT. We've got a 100% renewable energy target. We've got a government that's committed to, in the middle of building, a very large public transport investment, light rail. We've introduced the land tax reform an economic reform where we scrapped stamp duty and replaced it with land tax. These are reforms that every other jurisdiction around the country struggles to implement. But of course, here in the ACT, we have a minority government where Labor shares power with the Greens, elected with proportional representation. Are you sure you can't get anything done under proportional representation?
That's a good argument you make. And the point is, anything that the Greens will tick, if Labor wants to do it, can get up.
Mm.
But they have a veto on every single thing. An example this week, which really annoys me, there is a policy position in the ACT, bipartisan, used to be, which was to try and get no landfill waste. Very big and sensible thing. So part of that has to be that you get waste which exists and is never going to be wished away by some idiotic proposition about banning packaging or something, and converted to energy, just like every major developed technological country in the world does. But we don't get to have one here because the Greens say, well, we're not allowed to. And the Liberal Party, in their opportunism, have acquiesced to that. Now, that is a ludicrous proposition. It's not even good environmentally. And it's just one example, and there would be myriad of them as well.
But look, I don't really know much about the incinerator, but what you're saying is,
let's be clear, it's not an incinerator. It is a system which gasifies and then combusts. Well, there's a whole variety of technologies.
Sorry, I wasn't trying to make it.
No, but this is the whole point. The Greens called an incinerator. It's a lie.
Right.
Insinuating that it's going to poison people. It has zero emissions. Zero. And yet, you know, that's not good enough because you don't deal in facts.
But I know nothing about it. My point is that if the Liberal Party and the Greens both oppose it, that's a majority of the parliament opposing it. Isn't that democracy doing its thing?
No, it's an idiotic it's an idiotic proposition, because the stated position of everyone was to get rid of landfill waste over 25 years. And we're making a good contribution. We would have been the first jurisdiction, I think, in the world to do that. Certainly one of the first. But, you know, and it's not only the Greens. Like, you know, if Tony Abbott had the balance of power somewhere, or Barnaby Joyce, you know, he'd be allowed to do whatever he liked and you know, put photographers in prison or in hospital. But, gee, if you went to go and see a family planning person, you'd be on television.
Mm.
I mean, I'm not saying the hypocrisy. And that's the whole point. It is just another bad layer of uncertainty, which we don't need. There's enough checks and balances on real, you know, with real matters, in my view.
Well, I think there's one thing that's clear, is that in the sensible centre, we need to have diversity in the parliament, but, you know, can't probably agree on how much we need. Thanks for joining us in the sensible centre.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
That was Chris Fry from the sensible centre. Thanks for joining us again on The Lucky Country. The Lucky Country is brought to you by Schwartz Media, publisher of the Saturday paper, The Monthly, and indeed my latest quarterly essay, and Future Super, Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund.